you can sit behind a computer and tell me what you think would have been cooler. For instance, like, did I come back too soon? Maybe. Yeah. But until you watch next week, you don't know what the explanation is.
That was CM Punk on the BS Report with Bill Simmons this past week, talking about his return to WWE, which took place on Raw this past Monday night. We'll get to all that in just a moment. This is the Solid Monster. This is the Sound Off, in fact, episode 170 here on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, July 31st, 2011. Hope everybody's having a great weekend. And boy, the CM Punk return, which came a lot quicker than I thought it would, has stirred a lot of emotion in a lot of people. Good, mostly bad, let's be honest. I was frightened to go on my Facebook page after Raw Monday night. In fact, I took one peek at my Facebook page after Raw Monday, and I actually logged out, went to bed, and pulled the covers over my head. I was so afraid. My God, there were a lot of pissed off people this past week. Still are, actually. And I'm not quite sure why all the hate, but we'll get to that in a second. In fact, let's just jump into Raw right here. The good, the bad, and the ugly from the big show this past Monday night. This was the show that was billed as Triple H's first night in charge as the COO. It's kind of interesting they're referring to him as the chief operating officer and not the chairman of WWE, which means that Vince McMahon is still chairman. I guess they probably did that to avoid any sort of issues with the stock like they had last time when Donald Trump had bought Raw. Although back then they actually put a press release out to tell people that Donald Trump had bought Raw. And that's kind of a problem when you have a publicly traded company and a lot of the people who perhaps had invested in your company aren't made aware of the fact that this is a storyline. So this is a little bit different than that, but it was Triple H's first night in charge in the finals of the WWE Championship Tournament made by Vince McMahon the week before, pitting Rey Mysterio against The Miz. So what I want to do first here, before I get into the good, the bad, the ugly, and all that, I'm not going to give a full Raw review here. Going to keep things rolling along, but I want to give a quick synopsis, an overall synopsis of the show. What did I think of Raw Monday night? All I got were messages from people who were incensed, just angered to their bone, to their core by what they saw on Monday night. I mean, I could not believe all of the hatred that was lobbed at this show. All the people who basically, after days and weeks of showing optimism and expressing, really positive emotions about wrestling and how it was an exciting time to be a wrestling fan, and for once WWE was doing something right. And in one fell swoop, when CM Punk came out at the end of that show, really when John Cena won the championship and then CM Punk came out at the end of Raw, it was like I was living in some parallel universe where the universe had shifted in a heartbeat. But when I came away from the show, I thought it was a good show overall. Here's my thing. My biggest fear is what we're seeing here is a carbon copy of the Nexus angle from last year, where you've got a hot act, it feels different, it feels special, the fans are behind it, and then you go to SummerSlam, and John Cena wins clean and kills the whole thing dead. I mean, I fear that's where we're headed this time with CM Punk, but, you know, Punk is no rookie. That's the big difference between the Nexus last year and Punk now. Punk has been around the block couple of times. And I have faith that win or lose, he's going to come out of this better for having been part of this angle. Whereas the Nexus, I mean, look, in many respects, it put those guys on the map. It put Wade Barrett on the map. And you can argue that what Wade Barrett has been doing on Raw, or rather on SmackDown, has been floundering. I mean, at one point, Wade Barrett was a bona fide main eventer in WWE. And he's very good on the microphone. He's not bad in the ring. And he's been relegated to mid-card status in recent months. But in this case, again, Punk was already a star. This made him a superstar. And I don't think that regardless of what happens at SummerSlam, I don't think anything's going to change that. So that's a positive. You remember when Edge, for example, finally broke through the glass ceiling back in 2006 and became a main event star. You know, that didn't mean that he was in main event matches on pay-per-view every single month until the day he retired. If Punk loses the championship and they move on, let's say, to a John Cena-Alberto Del Rio feud, I'm optimistic that Punk is going to be okay. Now, what does not give me a lot of enthusiasm is the fact that there were apparently roughly half a dozen different scripts put together for the show last Monday before they went on the air. And the one that they nearly chose, they came very close to choosing the script that had the scenario where Triple H was to have pedigreed CM Punk at the end of the show and cost him the championship with Alberto cashing in his Money in the Bank briefcase. The fact that they would even think of having Hunter destroy CM Punk this early just makes me quiver. How they could possibly think that would have been a good idea is mind-boggling to me. And look, the fact is they didn't go with it. If we sat here and judged them strictly on all the bad ideas they had that they didn't use, this company wouldn't even exist anymore. But coming out of the show Monday, I didn't have that level of hatred and vitriol for it that a lot of people seem to have. People were expecting me to just tear this show to shreds as though this was the worst show they had ever seen. And again, one of the things I like about letting several days go by is I'm able to look back on it with a pure eye, if you will. You know, I don't have any sort of emotion coming out of the show where I'm really pissed off or I really think, oh, that was the best show ever. You know, you let a couple days go by, you calm down a little bit, you look back and you say, you know what, this show wasn't that good, or maybe it was. And when I came out of the show Monday, my thought really wasn't any different than it is now. I don't see why people are bitching so much. There are parts of this show that I have a problem with, and I'm going to get into that right now. But on the whole, Raw is still must-see TV the way that it has not been in many years. So, for example, I'm looking forward to Raw this coming Monday night. I'm very curious, more than anything else, how they explain the quickness with which CM Punk is back on television. And Punk is going to cut a promo on Monday night. So, to me, one of the highlights of WWE television these last, month and a half, 2 months, or whatever it is, has been CM Punk on the microphone. So we're guaranteed to get a Punk promo on Monday night, and I'm looking forward to that. Let's just go through the good stuff on this show. Since a lot of people seem to think there was none, I'm here to counter that opinion. There was a lot of good stuff on this show, in fact. Rey Mysterio and The Miz had a really fun match at the beginning of the show. It had time. It went well over 10 minutes. It was nice to see, you know, after asking on 169 here last week about when the last time was that we saw an actual wrestling match open up a TNA Impact show. Impact, mind you, where, quote, wrestling matters. And it was nice to see that after asking that, we got a hot match like this to open Raw. And Rey Mysterio wins, as I predicted, I think a lot of people did, becomes WWE Champion for the very first time. I noticed early on in the show that there was something off about that belt, and clearly it was just, you know, a replica belt that anybody could buy that they just use for the purposes of this angle. So, you know, I don't know what that means, but there you go. So for the people who wanted to know, was it a replica? Yes, it was a toy replica. After the match, all the Raw guys backstage dousing Mysterio in champagne, Rey mentioning his family. It really helped put over the significance of winning the title. So good stuff on that. The other big thing about this show, of course, Jim Ross. I certainly didn't see this coming. A lot of people didn't. WWE went to some painstaking measures to make sure that even the wrestlers backstage did not know that Jim Ross was coming back. Apparently, he was not in the backstage area. They were hiding him in a hotel up until a certain point. Then they had him segregated from everybody else, and then he went out before the live audience. So Jim Ross is back. It appears to be, I can't even call it a permanent move, because we all know at some point that Vince is just going to take him off again. But for now, for the time being, it's what I'll call a temporary permanent move, in that this is intended for JR to be on television every week for the foreseeable future. And hey, need I say more? I did chuckle at the people on Facebook who were giving credit during this show to Triple H for bringing JR back, as though he really had any influence into this whatsoever. It's a storyline, people. But anyway, good to see Jim Ross back. He was a little shaky early on, but that's to be expected. And he made the main event feel really special, a lot more special than it probably would have if Michael Cole would have been calling it, so that's a plus. I haven't been a fan of the way R-Truth's character has devolved since he turned heel, but if that's the role that he's settled into, and it appears he has, he's basically playing the same whacked-out comedy character every week now, if that's what it's going to be, then I will say he's doing a hell of a job. You know, he's over the top? Absolutely. But I actually laughed at some of his comedy with Triple H during their in-ring segment. I don't often laugh at WWE comedy these days, but there was some pretty good stuff between them back and forth. You know, when Hunter started talking to imaginary voices and mocking R-Truth, and Truth just looked at him with this look on his face and said, "Man, you crazy!" I laughed out loud. So that was good stuff. Zack Ryder got to wrestle a match on Raw, and he actually won. He got an entrance. He wrestled, albeit for 30 seconds, against Michael Cole, and he won. It's like the universe got turned on its ear Monday night. Again, it was against Michael Cole, but a match is a match, and at least he got to beat the crap out of him for 30 seconds, so I'm totally fine with that. The crowd did not react to him at all when he first came out, but during the match, they picked up, they had loud chants of Let's Go Ryder, which was nice to see. So anyway, I'll have more on Zach in a little bit during the SmackDown recap. Wouldn't you know it, I get to put the Divas in the good column this week. After what I had to say last week, really over the last couple of weeks, it's actually nice to be able to put them in the good category for a change. Not that the match that they had on Monday was all that great, but they actually gave the Divas more than 60 seconds, which was nice to see. Even Kelly beat Melina and Maryse. And I also noticed that between Eve shaking her ass in the middle of this match before she did a standing moonsault, and Kelly doing the stink face, which she's been doing for a little while now, but we're starting to see a bit more raunchiness when it comes to the women. You know, and again, for all the people who like to complain about PG, PG this, PG that, they seem completely oblivious to things like this. Things like this, the Punk angle over the last several weeks. You know, even if WWE were to abandon PG, which they won't, they wouldn't announce it in advance. They're not going to put a press release out announcing the end of PG. It's not like they're going to flip a switch one night. It would be a gradual transition. You wouldn't even notice it right away. And I'm not saying that that's where we're at right now, that that's what we're seeing. But it's nice to see them pushing the envelope with these things a little bit more, trying to be a little more realistic, trying to be a little more edgy, having the Divas do certain things that, quite frankly, we haven't seen them do much of the last couple of years. So it's actually refreshing to see it. And if the people who are complaining about PG would shut up for a second and quit bitching for 1 second, they might actually take notice of this sort of thing. John Cena and Rey Mysterio had a really good main event. It started slow. Crowd was pretty quiet. Really as quiet as you'll ever see them for a Cena match. Because you have two of the biggest baby faces in the entire company, at least in terms of the kids. So they didn't know how to react. They didn't know who to root for. And as the match wore on, the crowd came alive. We got some pretty good near falls. It felt fresh to see Rey in there with Cena, because it's a match we really haven't seen much, if at all, before. Certainly not a big-time, you know, championship match like this. And it's certainly a lot better than if we would have gotten another John Cena versus Miz match. I'm not blaming Miz for that either, but Cena and Miz, I just keep thinking back to WrestleMania and that god-awful piece of crap match they had. But anyway, having said that, so again, Cena Mysterio turned out to be a really good main event. Having said all of that, let's move on to the bad. I see a great deal of hate for John Cena. I think that goes without saying. I mean, passionate disdain for this man. And there was lots of vitriol after the show, as I said, on Facebook, to the point of absurdity, quite frankly. I just could not believe what I was seeing. And I thought that in the match with Mysterio, Cena did what he could. I mean, Rey wrestled circles around him, and they had a really good match. But if you take Rey Mysterio out of the equation, the match would have been awful. Just awful. I mean, Cena looked slow, he looked plodding, he botched a couple of moves, including a powerbomb on Rey at one point, where he literally just threw. I mean, he launched Rey out of the corner across the ring and nearly killed the poor guy. Just completely reckless. I'm not even sure what that was supposed to be. And then there was another spot in the match where Cena yet again, called out a spot. He shouts for a head scissors. So everybody knew what was coming. So Rey executes a head scissors takeover, and Cena looks completely awkward going over. Just took the worst head scissors I've seen in ages. And he called for it. And on top of all that, Cena wins the match and is once again, he is the WWE champion. I did not agree with this finish. I would concur 100% with all the people out there who were upset that Cena yet again wins the championship as though he has to. as though Cena cannot exist on this planet without having that title in his possession. Which leads me to the return of CM Punk. They could not even keep the guy off television for more than a week before bringing him back. And again, I played that audio at the beginning of the show from Punk's own mouth. He was on Bill Simmons' podcast, and he said, "Judge it as it unfolds. Don't judge it now. Wait for the explanation." And in many respects, I agree. Perhaps Punk will come out on Raw this week. He'll work his verbal magic as he is known to do on the microphone. He'll have a perfectly logical explanation for why he agreed to come back and to re-sign with Triple H. It may well be. But we're all human beings. We all have a brain. We all formulate our own thoughts and opinions. And watching this show, it seemed to me that he came back too soon. You know, they go through all of this drama leading up to Money in the Bank about what's going to happen to the WWE if Punk wins and he walks out with the title, which he does. And then they announce that he's been stripped of the title. And they put together a tournament to crown a new champion. So they shoot the footage at Comic-Con with Punk and Hunter, during which you'll recall that Hunter asked Punk how life was in the unemployment line. And Punk responded by saying that it was great. And he actually wasn't even looking for a job. Liar. All of that. And here's CM Punk walking out at the end of the show after Cena already won back the title with brand new theme music and a brand new Titantron, apparently re-signing with Triple H. Now, again, I look forward to Punk's first promo, but this is an angle that could have and should have stretched out over at least a couple of more weeks, if not a few months. And it's being condensed into a matter of a couple of weeks, if that. Not even. I mean, it reminds me, in a lot of ways, it reminds me of Chris Jericho talking about his storyline with Shawn Michaels back in 2008. How it's his favorite program of all time that he ever did. And, you know, they milked it for more than 6 months, and they got the most out of it that they could, in spite of WWE. WWE wanted to literally run through the entire thing between Jericho and Shawn back in 08 in a month or two, and then move on. And unfortunately, to me anyway, it looks like more of the same here. I understand they want Punk at SummerSlam. SummerSlam is one of their biggest shows of the year. I get that. But sometimes you got to bite the bullet and just say, you know what? For the betterment of our company, for the betterment, you know, long term, take a hit in the short term, because in the long run, it's going to pay off more. So I'm not ready to declare this angle dead just yet like a lot of people are. A lot of people listening to this right now, oh, this thing is dead. I'm not ready to do that. You know, oh my God. Henny Penny, the sky is falling. But I would have handled it differently than they did. That's my opinion. But again, I'm going to wait. I'm going to see what Punk has to say on Monday night. Now, couple of other, actually really one other bad thing. Michael Cole is still being kept part of the Raw announce team. Terrible. Absolutely terrible. So, my question is, does this mean that we're going to get JR, King, Cole, and Booker T as a four-man pay-per-view booth now? Or can we finally get rid of Booker T? I shudder to think of what a four-man booth would be like with those people. But the idea of Vince McMahon, through Michael Cole, ragging on JR every week as he did on Raw Monday is not something I'm looking forward to. Plus, you know, while I love seeing Zack Ryder back on TV, I don't ever need to see Michael Cole and his hideous tattoos wrestling on my TV ever again. I'm not even sure what those tattoos are supposed to be. When I first saw them, I thought they were henna tattoos that rubbed off, but apparently not. They're real tattoos, and they don't look good. And the only thing I have listed here under ugly is the fact that this company is so terrified. I mean, absolutely terrified to keep the title away from John Cena for any length of time. That fact is just startling to me. I don't understand why. You know, it's like a child who's afraid of the dark. You know, you flip a switch and they freak the fuck out. And I feel like with WWE, when you flip that switch, it's like the title disappears off of Cena's waist. And they all just start running around with their hands on their heads, freaking out. And I just don't understand why. I don't get it. I can't get over how bad it looks when Cena lost cleanly to CM Punk at the pay-per-view. And yet here he is again with the title, and we're expected to take it seriously. Which leads me to a rant. I talked about this on Twitter. Twitter.com/Solomonster, by the way. I said that I was going to comment on this podcast this week. And I feel this needs to be addressed. And that is the automatic rematch rule in WWE. And I know you know what I'm talking about. The champion loses on pay-per-view. He loses his title. So he comes out on Raw the next night, and he talks about the fact that I've got my rematch, my automatic rematch, and I want your ass in this ring tonight so I can get my championship back. And quite frankly, I think I'm pretty sure I've seen challengers who compete for the title on pay-per-view and lose, who never even win the championship, coming out the next night and saying that they're entitled to a rematch. Now, maybe I'm making that up and I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I've seen that before. But either way, the automatic rematch rule in WWE sucks. I don't understand where it started. I don't understand why it exists. I don't understand anything about it. When did this start consistently, anyway, is what I ask myself. And I ask myself this after Raw Monday night because, again, John Cena, I'm pretty sure, lost clean to CM Punk at the pay-per-view, and yet somehow Triple H comes out and says that John Cena deserves a rematch. He gets his rematch, and then Cena gets the rematch for the championship. This match, of course, with Rey Mysterio, wins the title, and he is an 11-time champion, and it leaves me scratching my head wondering, what the fuck did John Cena do to deserve another title shot? So I did a little bit of research here. Unscientific research using the wonderful tools at our disposal, including Google and Wikipedia. And from that, there were a couple of examples of this in 2006, is when I first really started to see this stipulation being used as a crutch. But it really seems to have started around 2007. That's when I start to see a lot of different examples of it. The only real example of this sort of thing in 2005 that I came up with would have been Triple H and Batista, but that's a little bit different. You know, Triple H and Batista had a three-match pay-per-view program. They had a WrestleMania match where Batista won the belt from Triple H. There was a rematch the next month at, I guess, what would have been the Backlash pay-per-view. And then at the next Raw show, which I think was the Bad Blood, they had a Hell in a Cell match. And Triple H lost all three matches. So certainly, Triple H, if nothing else, did not deserve a third match, but there was. But that doesn't really have anything to do with this particular rule. This seems like something that they came up with only in the last couple of years. You know, you look back on some of the older years. 2004, for example. Big match at SummerSlam. Randy Orton beats Chris Benoit to become the World Heavyweight Champion for the very first time. Beats Benoit clean. He didn't use a foreign object. I don't recall there being any interference, at least none that played into the finish. And, you know, at the end of the day, Benoit gets up, he goes up to Orton, he tells him to be a man, shake his hand. And that was it. I don't think there was ever, a rematch between them for the title. It's not like Benoit came out on Raw the next night and said, well, I get my automatic rematch. No, he lost fair and square. He goes right back in line with everybody else and waits his turn for another title shot. That's how it's always worked. Always. It's always been that way. You know, in 1998, Kane, his one-day reign, his famous one-day reign as the WWF champion, he beat Steve Austin at the King of the Ring in the first blood match. Austin got screwed. So Austin gets his shot the next night. Austin came out on Raw. He convinced Kane to give him a title shot. Kane said yes. And, of course, Kane proceeded to lose the championship back to Steve Austin. That's fine. It wasn't like Austin had an automatic rematch. And, quite frankly, in that scenario, it would have been okay because Austin literally got screwed out of the championship. You know, 2001, The Rock lost the title at WrestleMania to Steve Austin. The Rock got screwed at WrestleMania 17. So he came out the next night, and I don't remember exactly what promo, what was said that led to it. But again, this automatic bullshit didn't exist back then. But you know what? The Rock got a steel cage match on Raw the very next night with Austin. And I'm pretty sure the title was on the line, and that's fine. Why? Because The Rock got screwed out of the title. He deserved a rematch. I'm fine with rematches for that purpose. I got no problem with it. But this is just, it's a crutch for lazy writers and lazy bookers. I mean, if you're automatically in line for a title shot, you automatically know that you're going to get a rematch if you lose. Then what's the motivation to go all out to win? Ah, who cares? I'll just cash in my rematch on Raw or SmackDown. or the next pay-per-view if I lose. Who gives a shit? In the case of John Cena, I mean, what did he do to deserve a rematch? Give me one good reason why John Cena deserved a rematch for the championship. Why it was so pressing for Triple H to put him in a title match that very same night against Rey Mysterio, who had already wrestled. What logic does that make? What sense does any of this make? Cena was the entire reason that the company was in this mess in the first place with Punk leaving with the championship, because he got pinned fair and square at Money in the Bank. And don't give me that bullshit, well, Vince McMahon and Johnny Ace distracted him excuse. Punk was also distracted by them during the match and walked right into an STF. So fuck off with that. It irritates the hell out of me. Every fucking month it's the same bullshit. I get my rematch. You know, I talked at the beginning about how important they made the championship feel. Rey Mysterio won the belt after a great match. He went backstage. Big celebration. It really meant a lot to this guy, you know? First time he ever won the WWE title. And they did a hell of a job to make it feel special. And I can't help but feel that by the end of the show, it was literally one step forward, two steps back. They make it feel special, and then they bring you right back down to reality. And they make the championship seem pointless. Who cares? Hell, there's two titles now. Three, I guess, if you count the SmackDown title. Now you got two guys walking around with the championship, which is fine, although, again, I would have waited a couple of months, but that's a different story. But this automatic rematch rule in WWE must be abolished. It must be eliminated immediately. It does not make any sense. It has no place in wrestling. It's stupid. And it just makes the championship seem that less special. Triple H was also on SmackDown this week. I haven't seen all of SmackDown yet, only part of it. Christian and John Morrison had a hell of a match early on in the show. Zack Ryder was named Teddy Long's assistant general manager, so I guess he's filling in the old Vicky Guerrero role. Sheamus appears to be going face. Mark Henry beat the crap out of a jobber and complained to Teddy Long that Teddy promised him competition. And he failed. He has not given him any suitable competition. So Sheamus came out, got a big reaction from the crowd. They were actually chanting his name at one point. And Sheamus, I think, yeah, he slapped him across the face. Mark Henry went after him. Sheamus pulled down the top rope. Mark Henry went flying out of the ring, crash landed on the floor. And Sheamus got a chair. Mark Henry told him, put down the chair. And, of course, Sheamus is a smart guy, so he said no. And I don't know exactly where they're going with this. I assume they're building up to maybe a match at SummerSlam. That would certainly make sense. And it appears that Sheamus, if he hasn't already gone face, is heading in that direction. And they didn't seem to be doing much with Sheamus on SmackDown. And so why not? Maybe the crowd gets behind him and you have a bona fide number one or number two babyface behind Randy Orton. So they're trying something new. Sheamus seems to have a lot of support from the people. So we'll see how that works out. And R-Truth was on SmackDown. He got put in a match with Randy Orton that he won by disqualification. Then he got RKO'd twice on the announce table. But yeah, R-Truth on SmackDown. Brand split be damned. Here's your SmackDown report. Now, for those of you who have asked about TNA, Spike TV, there's been some unsettling news over the last week or two. So here's the deal. There was a conference of marketing executives a couple of weeks ago. And at that conference, officials from Spike TV indicated that they are likely going to be rebranding their network yet again. I don't know if that means a name change, but they'll be rebranding. And they're going to be targeting males and females, age 18 to 49, whereas right now, Spike really only targets men, age 18 to 34. So they're expanding that age group, and they're including females and not just males. So it will no longer be a network for men, which is how they were billing themselves early on when they rebranded themselves as Spike. So they expect to lose UFC programming, and this has been known now for a couple of months. It's no secret that there's a 99% chance that at the end of their television contract, UFC's television contract, with Spike, which expires, I believe, at the end of December, UFC programming will no longer be on Spike TV. UFC officials have been in negotiations with a lot of different television networks for a while now, and they are confident they're going to end up on a major network. The question is, which one? Is it going to be a network like an ABC? A CBS? Is it going to be a cable network? ESPN? Nobody knows. But the consensus is that UFC will no longer be on Spike. So what does this mean for TNA? And what does this new direction for the network mean for TNA and for Impact Wrestling? I mean, the show, as much as they're stuck in a rut, and no matter what they do, they cannot seem to really grow their audience. They're always in that 1.0 to 1.3 range. Very rarely, if ever, do they break out of that. But the fact is, they still bring in anywhere from 1.5 million to about 1.8 million viewers each week, which a lot of shows don't do. And if Spike were to drop TNA, here's what would happen to TNA. They would die. End of story. That's it. That's how important Spike is to TNA at this point. And really, that's how important Spike has always been to TNA. But TNA's financial fortunes have not gotten any better over the last couple of years. So if Spike pulls the plug and nobody comes in to offer them another spot on another network, or Vince McMahon himself does not swoop in and just buy the rights to the company, they will simply die. They will cease to exist. And the fact is, for the people who are worried about this, the really diehard TNA fans, or quite frankly, even fans who don't like TNA, but they like the idea that TNA is around, I think that's a whole other subset of wrestling fans. You have a lot of wrestling fans that either just don't care enough to watch TNA, or they think TNA is absolute dog shit, but they like the idea that TNA is around because, A, it's more job opportunities for wrestlers, and B, they just like knowing that there's some form of competition out there to WWE. There's an alternative. As bad as they may be, 8 times out of 10, it's nice having more than one national wrestling promotion. And I agree with that. I agree with that. But for the people who are worried that this might actually happen, don't be. I would be, quite frankly, I would be stunned if that actually happened. I think Spike will keep TNA. I don't know, you know, will they move TNA to a different night? Who knows? You know, they have to rebrand first, and then we have to figure out exactly what, you know, their new schedule is and all of that stuff. But will they drop TNA? If I were a betting man, I'd bet on no. So right now, this doesn't have any impact, no pun intended, no impact on TNA. If anything, it could be a positive impact, I think, because if UFC leaves, my guess is that they're probably just going to pick up another MMA organization, maybe something like a, well, Strikeforce is owned by UFC, maybe something like a Bellator, you know, which is currently on MTV2. I don't see them giving up on MMA completely. They'll probably just replace UFC with a smaller MMA promotion. But TNA then, by default, becomes the biggest property they have in terms of sports and entertainment. And perhaps they'll devote more money to TNA. Supposedly, in the next couple of weeks, Spike is kicking in a little bit of money so that TNA can actually go on the road, I think every other week, with road tapings for Impact, which is a huge plus for the company. You know, they had that one taping in Fayetteville back in February, outside of the Impact Zone. And the consensus was, I don't even remember, some people thought the show was good, some people thought it was crap, but the one thing everybody pretty much agreed on was that the show felt much more professional. It felt special, it felt different. Why? Because they were in a building other than that fucking Impact Zone. You have to get out of the Impact Zone. You have to get on the road. You have to get into real buildings, real arenas. You know, they're still, after 9 years, they're not in a position to go into an arena and fill it up with 8,000 people like WCW used to do on Nitro. You know, they would take Nitro to big buildings and they would fill it up, and Nitro felt like a big deal. TNA is not even close to being able to do that. But so what? Fill up some of the smaller buildings. You can get 2,000 people here, 2,500 people there. And Spike is helping to kick in some of the money for that. So if anything, if they lose UFC in a couple of months, you know, maybe Spike caters a little bit more to TNA, kicks in a little more money for them to do more tapings and stuff like that. So it's for the people who have asked, I wouldn't freak out over it. I don't see this having any negative impact yet on TNA. Not this year. According to the recent edition of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, some pay-per-view news here, and it's not all that great. WWE, their Capital Punishment event back in June, only did 83,000 buys domestically in North America. That's not good. That is not good at all. And I would say that it's a bad sign for Money in the Bank, but I still really think that Money in the Bank will end up doing really well. What is the definition of doing well? I don't know. I know it's a hell of a lot more than 83,000. In fact, I'm willing to bet that domestically, I would hope, Money in the Bank more than doubled the number that Capital Punishment did. So I guess it'll be another month or so before we know for sure. But even worse to me anyway, even worse is that TNA's Destination X pay-per-view has apparently, and again, TNA does not release these numbers like WWE does as a publicly traded company, but there are people in the know in the cable industry that have said that the Destination X show did 8,000 buys, which is actually right around what TNA normally does for their pay-per-views. And that's why it's so horrible, because I think a lot of people were hoping and counting on the fact that Destination X, which put all the focus on the smaller guys and all the focus on the really good workers in TNA, Abyss aside, but you had people like Brian Kendrick and Rob Van Dam, Jerry Lynn, AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, Kazarian, all these different people, even the people they brought in, you know, people like Jack Evans and Austin Aries and all of those guys on that pay-per-view, busting their ass, having great matches, and taking the focus off of Hulk Hogan, and taking the focus off of Ric Flair, and off of Sting, and off of, you know, Jeff Jarrett, and all of those people, same old, same old, and putting it on the younger guys and the smaller guys. And apparently it didn't really result in any increase at all in what TNA normally does. Now, the flip side of looking at this, whole entire thing is that, well, this was a pay-per-view that didn't feature any of the big names like Hulk Hogan, Kurt Angle, Ric Flair, Sting. None of the advertising was focused on them either. And yet, the same number of people that buy all those pay-per-views with those guys bought a pay-per-view that had practically none of them except Rob Van Dam on the entire show. So you can look at it like that as well. But to me, I would have hoped, if I were TNA and if I were any of those X Division guys, I would have hoped that this pay-per-view would have done double what TNA usually does. They did it with Hardcore Justice last August. That was a show that did about 20,000 buys. But again, that's a gimmick that you cannot do every year. Hardcore Justice, they're still calling it Hardcore Justice this year, but it's not an ECW homecoming type of show. It's just another pay-per-view. And anyway, so I don't know what it means for the future of the X Division. You know, for people in that company, Eric Bischoff and all those people who have their own mentality, and then they try something different, and then when they don't see any noticeable increase, and they live and die by the ratings, and they live and die. Actually, I shouldn't say TNA lives and dies by pay-per-view numbers, because TNA does not give a fuck about pay-per-view, apparently, since their pay-per-views really are just used to promote their free TV shows. But as far as, you know, what impact it has on the X Division, I guess we'll see. But to me, I don't think anything really is going to change all that much in TNA. And also, this past week, The Miz was named number one on Pro Wrestling Illustrated's top 500 list. Now, PWI has had this top 500 going back all the way to 1991. And it used to be a very prestigious list. A lot of the wrestlers in the business, let alone the fans who actually bought the magazines back then, thought that it was a very big deal. It was a very big deal who was number one, who was in the top 100, all that sort of thing. In 2011, it doesn't mean as much. The magazines don't sell as much. It doesn't carry as much weight. But it's still a big deal to a lot of people. I'm sure it's a big deal to The Miz becoming number one. Last year, AJ Styles took that honor. He was number one. And other big names over the years have taken the top spot. Triple H, Randy Orton, Hulk Hogan, John Cena, Chris Benoit, Brock Lesnar, Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels. All of them, at one point or another, have been number one in the PWI Top 500. And what makes it even bigger is, again, you look at The Miz and his story and where he came from. Coming up from a reality show background, came into wrestling, people did not take him seriously. A lot of people still don't take him seriously. They think he has a baby face, or the way he dresses, or just they just can't take the guy seriously. But I will say this, I've had that problem as well. But in recent weeks, for me, he's turned a little bit of a corner in that respect. You know, he had that great match with Rey Mysterio. His promo work is top-notch. If he develops a little more of a mean streak in his character and they have him really, again, I think this is one of those situations where blood in wrestling would really help somebody. I think if Miz had one or two really bloody battles with people, that it would help. There's something about the image of a wrestler just wearing the proverbial crimson mask after a hard-fought battle that just makes you go, you know what, that guy is one tough SOB. And I feel like guys like The Miz, they can't benefit from that because of the blood ban in WWE. But nonetheless, again, Miz was not that good when he first started, and a lot of people didn't take him seriously. And he changed his look, he changed his gear, he changed his moveset, His promo work has always been good, but it's gotten better over time. And he's also done what John Cena has done. He's thrown himself into media work and PR work and promotion work with the WWE. He has a day off. He'll use his day off to go do media interviews all day long in a particular city. There is no day off for The Miz. He's got a very high work ethic, and I respect the hell out of the guy for that. And you know what? Congratulations to The Miz. He deserves it. I want to give a quick shout-out here to an old friend of mine, Ryan Katz, the former ringside Ryan Andrews. I used to appear, or at least I did for several weeks, as a call-in newsman on an old wrestling radio show that Ryan had up in the Boulder, Colorado area. This would have been back around 1999, maybe 2000. So it goes back even a little bit further than those audio clips I played some time back of the other radio show that I used to call into. This was my first foray into doing this for a wrestling show. We used to have a segment called Shoo Me, Schiavone, which of course was a playoff. Tony Schiavone was just mercilessly ribbed by wrestling fans back in the day and ridiculed. Everything to Tony was the greatest night in the history of our sport. What's actually great is that Tony is now on Twitter, so you can search for him on there. He actually has a Twitter page, and he's a minor league baseball announcer. But anyway, I actually was able to get reacquainted with Ryan recently, thanks to this website, as a matter of fact. And he made me aware of some of the things that he's worked on. He's done work, of course, for TNA, XPW. He's wrestled. He's done other things. He's a renaissance man. He's tried to promote. He's now, I think, got his own wrestling school. And he's trying to put together an event called Fight Night on the Strip in West Hollywood, California. And he's trying to do it the hard way, basically. A grassroots effort, if you will. Trying to raise money for everything in terms of being able to promote the show, pay for the wrestlers, many of which have already committed to doing the show, if the show does in fact happen, including Eric Watts, or Buckwheat, as he was called, from the most recent season of WWE Tough Enough on USA. And if you want to help out, if you want to pledge a donation to help make this wrestling project happen, something very unique, you can go to Kickstarter.com. Go to Kickstarter.com and in the search box type in Fight Night on the Strip. It should be the first and only result that comes up. If you click on that page, it will have all the details. I don't want to get into the whole thing here. It'll take me 15 minutes. There's a lot of information up there. If you don't really know what it's about and you want to know more and you want to possibly pledge a donation to help make this happen, it's a very unique project, and we need more creativity in wrestling. So go to Kickstarter.com, type in Fight Night on the Strip, and check out all the information there. And good luck to Ryan on that. He's a good guy, and hopefully that project will work out, and there'll be some good wrestling action out in California. That event would be taking place on August 23rd if it happens. So, again, go to Kickstarter.com and get more information on that. Let's get to your questions here. This first question comes from Matt. I already answered him directly, but it's a good question, and some matches here that perhaps some of you listening might want to check out. He asked, in celebration of Daniel Bryan's big victory at Money in the Bank, I was wondering if you could give a short list of his best matches and feuds to date in WWE. I can think of a few, but would really like to know what your list is. Also, could you please provide a short list of some of his best matches from Ring of Honor? D-Bry, as Booker T calls him, has only been in WWE a relatively short period of time, but he's had some pretty great matches. His first match on NXT with Chris Jericho was quite good. His series in the fall last year with Dolph Ziggler was fantastic stuff. And they had, I think, three matches in a row. I think one at the Bragging Rights pay-per-view, then Raw, then SmackDown. And of the three, if I remember correctly, their match on Raw after the pay-per-view was the best of the three. So that's one worth checking out. And he had one of, if not the best Sin Cara match in WWE on SmackDown about a month or two ago, even though he lost. It was a damn good match. So those are the big ones, other than the Money in the Bank match that he recently won, that spring to mind. As far as Ring of Honor is concerned, I mean, we could be here a while. If you take a list of all the 4- and 5-star efforts that he had in that promotion, I mean, you'd have a list of at least 20 or more. But a couple that spring to mind, he had a match with Lance Storm. Lance Storm came out of retirement for a match with him at the ROH Better Than Our Best event. You can look that one up. That was quite great. Definitely check out his title unification bout with Nigel McGuinness from the UK. His bloody battle with Takeshi Morishima at Ring of Honor's Final Battle show in 2008, which I attended live in New York City, by the way. And his battle with Kenta at Glory by Honor 5, Night 2, which was at the Hammerstein Ballrooms Actually, it was in the Grand Ballroom, I believe, at the Manhattan Center. The Hammerstein is on the first floor when you walk in. The Grand Ballroom is up on the eighth floor. And we had to walk up eight flights of stairs. That's the same ballroom where Monday Night Raw was taped for much of its first year. Just a little trivia note for you. But I was also live in attendance at that show. I believe Bruno Sammartino made a special appearance that night at the Ring of Honor show. And it was a great match between Daniel Bryan and Kenta. So those are a couple of suggestions. If people are not familiar with his work in ROH, clear out one of your nights this week and just find a couple of matches online, kick back and check them out. You will not regret it. If you are a wrestling fan, you have never seen Daniel Bryan, Bryan Danielson, whatever you want to call him, wrestling in Ring of Honor, the promotion that really helped make him what he is today. You owe it to yourself to go out of your way to check out any three of his matches. If you blindfold yourself, like pin the tail on the donkey and I spun you around five times and you pointed at a random Daniel Bryan match from his Ring of Honor tenure, I guarantee you no matter which three matches you pick, they'd all be great. So I just wanted to mention that. Luis from Illinois. Do you think Vince McMahon fulfilled a lifelong dream by appearing on Saturday Night Live with Big Show, Triple H, and Mick Foley back in 2000, and even getting to say the actual Live from New York line? Nope, my childhood dies every time I see Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair at 60 years of age, desperate for money and staining their legacy, which unfortunately happens far too often these days. That kills a piece of my childhood each time. Chris writes in with a very interesting suggestion here that I think is worth mentioning. He says, Dear Sala Monster, I'm a big fan of the podcast. I'm two-thirds of the Triple Threat. I follow you on Twitter and have subscribed on iTunes. I'm writing in because I heard you talking about possible opponents for Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania next year when he cashes in Money in the Bank. I like the few scenarios you had, but think you're missing the biggest one that could be, and in my opinion should be, The Undertaker. Now, I get that Bryan is in no way near the level of Undertaker at the moment, but they've got over 8 months to build him there as a giant killer. I saw on SE Scoops that Bryan mentioned that he's going to be working on more submissions to add to his arsenal, so that makes me think they've already considered this feud. Undertaker is not getting any younger and could use someone like a Daniel Bryan who could help carry the majority of the match. You can also throw in the fact that it's essentially a streak-for-streak match and that Taker's WrestleMania accomplishments against the fact that every time the briefcase is cashed in, we get a new champion. You know Undertaker's going to win, but the drama behind it could be something pretty exciting. Plus, it could add a little more of an uncertainty behind future briefcase cashings. And then there's Shawn Michaels. I'm sure you're aware Shawn is the man who trained Daniel Bryan how to wrestle. On the off chance that the angle is just not that hot with just the briefcase for a streak, you can always hotshot Shawn in, almost as the Jose Lothario for Daniel Bryan. The crowd would go insane if HBK superkicked Undertaker and pulled Daniel Bryan on top of him to get a near fall. I'm sure that as we get closer to the Rumble, things will become clearer. And, that's his idea. And I'll tell you what, I'm actually not opposed to that idea. I think that Daniel Bryan and The Undertaker could have a hell of a match at WrestleMania. The idea that Shawn would superkick Undertaker and would lead to a near fall, I don't see that happening. If Shawn Michaels didn't superkick Undertaker in the face like I thought he would when he fought Triple H, his best friend this year, then he's not going to do it for Daniel Bryan. And you know what? I don't think that feud needs Shawn Michaels involved. You know, if they wanted to do something on Raw, one of the Raws leading up to the pay-per-view where they went out of their way to mention, which they never really have. I mean, I guess they've mentioned it here and there, but they never really mentioned it a lot when he first came in that he was trained by Shawn Michaels, which he was. Maybe they could have Shawn on Raw, give him a pep talk, kind of like what Jake Roberts did on Raw with Randy Orton before Orton fought Undertaker back in 05. They could do something like that. But as far as an actual match, I like your idea a lot, actually. In fact, I could tell you that if they had a match, it would be a hell of a lot better than any Undertaker-Sting match would be. I think Undertaker-Sting, I would love to see it. It would have a lot of allure. Sting's first match in WWE, a fantasy match of sorts with him and Undertaker, even though both of them are well past their physical prime. But if you want a really good match, and Undertaker has shown us in the last couple of years that match quality matters to him. He's had some of the best quality matches of his career in the last half of his career. Most of the matches he had when he was the Undertaker back in the early 90s and the mid-90s, let's be honest, those matches sucked a cock, okay? Very few, if any, good matches, and it wasn't always his fault. I mean, look at the guys the poor guy was in there with. Giant Gonzalez, King Kong Bundy, Yokozuna, I mean, come on. And then you look at some of the matches he's had in the last 5 years. Matches with Triple H, Shawn Michaels, Kurt Angle. He even had a great match on SmackDown, I remember once, with Shelton Benjamin. So him and Daniel Bryan could have a hell of a match at WrestleMania. And the only thing that doesn't make sense is if Daniel Bryan is in fact going to cash in at WrestleMania, it doesn't make sense unless Undertaker already has the championship. And Undertaker should not have the championship. Undertaker should be done with championships. He doesn't need a championship. So if Daniel Bryan is not interested in cashing in on somebody at the last minute, he wants to do it in advance, then this idea doesn't work. But I still think it's a hell of an idea. Francisco writes in, "Dear Solomonster, I'm a big fan of the Sound Off since episode 146. I have a question for you. Which was the better match? The Rock versus Steve Austin at WrestleMania 17? Or Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25? In my opinion, those are two of the greatest matches in wrestling history. What do you think?" They were definitely two of the best matches in WWE history. And as far as which one was better, it's a matter of personal taste. I gotta go with Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. I mean, it's just almost impossible to touch that match. And, you know, if you were to ask me which is my favorite match of the two, Shawn Undertaker at WrestleMania 25 or John Cena CM Punk for Money in the Bank, that's a much more difficult question for me to answer, because it was so much fun to watch both of those matches. I think it was more fun, in a sense, to watch Cena and Punk, in large part because of the crowd. The crowd had a lot to do with that match being as good as it was, which is not like a handicap or anything like that. The crowd is part of every match. It just so happened that the crowd was a lot more amped up for that match than they were for Shawn Undertaker, although what Shawn Undertaker were able to do was get them into their match as it progressed, which is a lot harder to do. They didn't have a built-in storyline where people were going to be going nuts for both guys. They were in Texas, so they were in technically the home state of both guys. There was no hometown advantage, really. It kind of canceled each other out because they're both from Texas. That match had the benefit of being at a WrestleMania in front of 60-something thousand people. But I like, again, Shawn Undertaker, Austin Rock. Austin Rock was a great match. It was probably the best of their three WrestleMania matches. I gotta go with Shawn and Undertaker. It's just one of those matches that it's gonna be hard to top. Cordell Mitchell writes in, "Dear Solomonster, fan on Facebook and Twitter. I was hearing rumors of WWE turning John Cena heel before his match at WrestleMania next year, because when he's in the ring with The Rock, he gets the blunt of the heel reaction from the crowd, or he will anyway next year. I was feeling that this would be a mistake, because the match isn't built around a heel John Cena against the babyface Rock. It's built around two eras colliding, the Attitude Era and, of course, the current PG Superman Era with John Cena. I was wondering your thoughts on that, and would John Cena all of a sudden being an all-around heat magnet from women and kids make sense for this WrestleMania feud?" It would not. If John Cena just randomly one day in the next couple of months turned heel for no reason, just so he can be a heel at WrestleMania, that would suck. John Cena is going to be a heel. He doesn't have to turn heel. When he comes out, he's going to get booed. He's going to get booed like crazy in Miami next year. He'll have his share of fans. It's not as though there won't be any John Cena fans there. But yes, he will get booed. He does not have to turn heel. It's almost a waste, quite frankly, unless you come up with a good storyline reason, maybe in this current feud with him and Punk, to turn Cena heel, but it's just not going to happen. And I think you actually made a good point. In many respects, this is not a match of good guy versus bad guy. This is one era of wrestling against the current era of wrestling. It's the Rock Attitude Era against the John Cena, quote, PG era. And choose your side. May the best man win. That's really what it is. And, you know, for whatever it's worth, Cena on Twitter has multiple times, including this week. So if you go on his Twitter page right now, you'll probably go back by a couple of days, and you'll see he's answered questions about this from multiple people asking him, when are you going to go heel? Do you miss being a heel? And his answer is always the same. He says, I don't look at it like that. I wasn't a heel. I'm being me. As far as turning heel, I don't turn. I am who I am. People will either like me or hate me. Now, of course, he says that now. If Vince McMahon came to him and said, hey, kid, you're turning heel, then he would be turning heel. But that's a sign to me that it's just not going to happen. If it hasn't happened already, and God knows they've had so many golden opportunities to turn this guy heel, And they haven't done it. They haven't pulled the trigger. And again, he's still very successful as a babyface. He sells a lot of merchandise. A lot of the little kids look up to him. I think that in Vince McMahon's brain, his perverted, warped, psychotic brain, that there's something of a soft spot there where he sees this and just doesn't want to turn this guy heel and disappoint all the kids. I think that was a big reason why Hogan never turned heel once he went babyface. He never went back to being a heel in WWF. I'm sure part of it was fear, because they had Hogan was the golden goose, so even when he started to cool off a little bit, he was still the biggest star in the company, and Vince was probably too scared to turn him into a bad guy. But I think a big part of it is, you know, you always have these little... Back then you did. Back then, it was the cartoon era of WWF. You had a lot of kids watching, kind of like you do now. Although, again, I've said this ironically, there's fewer kids who watch WWE now than there were during the Attitude Era. But it's just not going to happen. So, all these questions I get about, is Cena going to turn heel? Should he turn heel? When's he going to turn heel? I get them almost as much as I used to get the Randy Savage Hall of Fame questions. And there's really no straight answer other than to say, he's not turning heel. He's already a heel to a lot of you guys anyway. What is this obsession with wanting to turn him heel? All the people who hate John Cena right now, who boo the fuck out of him, if they turned him into a heel and he was any good at it, which he kind of used to be, but that was a completely different character. I don't want him going back to being the doctor of Thugonomics, pretending he's a black guy even though he's white. If he turned heel now, he'd have to be completely different. Maybe he'd be the corporate champion or something. But then that would be too much of a ripoff of The Rock. So if he's not ripping off one person, he's ripping off another. But my point is, for all the people who hate John Cena's guts, they hate the character John Cena, and some people hate the person John Cena because they can't separate the two. If he turned heel and he was any good at his job, you'd start cheering for him. And that is the problem right there. If they go through all the trouble after all these years of actually turning the guy heel, only for people to start thinking, hey, he's pretty cool, I'm going to start cheering for him, it completely defeats the purpose. So I just wish these questions would stop. It's not going to happen. He's not turning heel. David writes in, Dear Solomonster, Sting's new Joker gimmick was awesome the first couple of weeks, but after this past Thursday night's Impact show, I feel that he needs to take his character back to 1997 and shut the fuck up. Wow. Well, I did not see Impact on Thursday. My Impact streak ended at 3 weeks. The streak is over, ladies and gentlemen. And no, Kevin Nash was not the one to end it. I did it myself. I committed Impact Wrestling suicide by ending my streak of watching it, just because I just wasn't able to. I wasn't really in the mood to. But from what I've seen of the Sting Joker character this past Thursday, from the clips I saw, I would actually have to agree. I was a huge fan of it at first. I thought it was fresh. I thought it was interesting. I thought it was kind of fun. And the second week, I kind of felt that way as well, but maybe a little less, and then a little less. And then I saw clips from the show on Thursday of Sting, and there's a difference between going a little bit over the top, which R-Truth kind of is with his character, and then Sting just takes it to a completely different level. I mean, the way his facial expressions, they're just so cartoony now. You can't take the guy seriously. And as your world champion, that's kind of a problem. So I don't know that he needs to ditch the character. I think if he just toned it down to maybe the way it was when he first started doing it all those weeks ago, that wouldn't be so bad. I mean, eventually he's going to probably go back to the way he was doing things anyway, to the Crow character. But it's kind of getting way out of control. And what was a good thing has now quickly become nothing more than your usual kind of TNA joke, can't take it seriously, it's actually kind of fucking annoying, please stop kind of a thing. So yes, I would agree. This question comes from Last Say, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, from Espoo Finland. He's a relatively new fan of the Sound Off, been a fan since episode 160. I found a great show to listen to during flights and long bus rides, he says. He says, like many other people, I've really enjoyed, or rather I should say I'm really annoyed, that's a big difference there, by the state of the commentating in WWE. I just watched Friday SmackDown, and one thing stuck out to me in the Christian versus John Morrison match, specifically in the commentating. During the whole duration of the match, the announcers only called two moves, the spear and the kill switch. The only reactions to the other moves were along the lines of, look at that, or that must hurt the neck. I think the credibility of the announcers is severely hurt by the fact that they seem to know nothing about the moves performed inside the ring. Even when they're not ranting about something completely unrelated, they pay no attention to the actual wrestling moves. Of course, I've noticed this before, but in this match, I paid special attention to the announcing, and the whole thing struck me as unacceptable. You can't be a wrestling announcer with no apparent knowledge of the sport. They really should bring back Matt Stryker to the announce team. At least he called the moves and actually knew what they were called. Current announcing in WWE is appalling. What is your take on this? Well, here's some food for thought. Matt Stryker was the only wrestling announcer in WWE actually calling maneuvers, as you said. And he would actually even point out little trivia facts about wrestling in Japan and you know, the old days and stuff like that. And ironically, Matt Stryker is the one that was taken off of the announce team. Now, I know that WWE was not happy with him at the Royal Rumble when Booker T came out and Kevin Nash came back as Diesel, and on commentary, he actually was, quote, marking out. He actually said that, "I'm marking out, bro, I'm marking out." Not a good thing to do. And that was probably as big of a reason as any why they took him off. But I find it ironic the one guy that actually knew the moves and was actually calling the maneuvers is the one they took off the announce team. So I would caution not to lay blame on the announcers. I mean, God knows Booker T, for example, knows the names of the fucking moves. He used to do half of them as a wrestler. Josh Matthews did some wrestling as well, and Josh Matthews actually is very well educated when it comes to wrestling maneuvers. Michael Cole does know more names than he lets on. It's not their fault. It's Vince McMahon's fault. Vince McMahon does not want them to name maneuvers. He wants them to tell stories because they're storytellers. That's what they are in WWE. He doesn't want them to, "Oh, that's a Hurricanrana." I mean, go back to Money in the Bank. CM Punk did a Hurricanrana off the top rope to John Cena. Nobody called that move. Not one of them called that fucking move. He did the move and they just kept talking. They completely ignored it. You know, early on in that Punk-John Cena match, Michael Cole mentioned Anaconda Vice at a time when CM Punk wasn't even doing the maneuver. But yet later in that same match, when Punk actually reversed out of an STF into the Anaconda Vice on John Cena and almost had Cena tap out, Michael Cole called it a submission maneuver. So this is the state of announcing in WWE in 2011. Now, the only saving grace I could think of is that Jim Ross is now back on the Raw announce team. But again, Jim Ross is told what to do. Jim Ross is not going to be on Raw Monday night calling every single maneuver. But I do think it will help. I think JR will call some moves. I think he'll try to, you know, bring a different voice to the announce booth that we have not had in a long time. It will help. But you work for Vince McMahon. You're doing what Vince McMahon tells you to do. And it sucks, I agree, it really does suck, that these guys can't go out and do their job. They're being held hostage by a madman. A madman in their ear. It's like, pretend that you're walking around all day long and you've got this little man in your ear yelling things in your ear and you can't get him out of there. You're on this fucking sidewalk with your head tilted to the side trying to knock him out of there. He just won't come out. It's like you got water in your ear when you get out of the beach, the ocean at the beach, you're trying to get the water out of your ear. That's kind of like what Vince McMahon is to these guys. He's trapped inside their heads and they can't get him fucking out of there. And I feel bad for those guys and I feel bad for all of us having to listen to it. Shaber writes in, "I know this might sound dumb, but does the NWA still exist?" Yes, they do, actually. The National Wrestling Alliance is still in existence. It's a group of promoters that hold membership in the NWA, continue to use the NWA name. None of the members, of course, are from the old days of the NWA. The NWA, as it once was, no longer exists, but technically speaking, the NWA in name is still around. And I know that Bob Trobick is the executive director of the NWA and deals with a lot of those matters related to the alliance. So, yes, it does still exist. Some promotions are part of it. It does not have the notoriety that it once had. It does not have the same weight and importance that it once had. But it is still around. Marcus writes in, "Dear Solomonster, I've been thinking about WrestleMania entrances and wonder what your favorite WrestleMania entrance of all time is. My favorite would be Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 12. Thanks for doing the show every week. Keep up the great work." I know I'm going to get beaten up for this, actually, but one of my all-time favorite WrestleMania entrances was Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 6, coming out for the champion-against-champion match at the Sky Dome with the Ultimate Warrior. And again, at the time, two of the biggest baby faces in the entire business, let alone in WWE. And Warrior is already in the ring. Warrior is in the ring, standing on the second turnbuckle, looking down as Hogan comes into the ring, rips the shirt off, the crowd's going nuts. And you've got the world champion and the intercontinental champion face-to-face, and Hogan's theme song, the most iconic wrestling theme song in history. And I still love it. You know, again, I was a Hogan fan when I was younger, and I look back on that entrance now, and it still gives me goosebumps. It was just fun. The place is going nuts, and two of the biggest stars ever in the ring, and anyway. My other favorite one is actually The Undertaker at WrestleMania 17, coming all the way down that long aisle at the Astrodome on his motorcycle. That probably was a rush for him, I'm guessing, being able to reach, maybe not top speed, but certainly Undertaker, if you come down a normal aisle way, you can't pick up speed the way he picked up speed at WrestleMania that year, coming down to the ring. So I thought that was pretty cool. And, you know, Shawn Michaels coming in on the harness at WrestleMania 12, 100 feet up at the Arrowhead Pond for his Iron Man match with Bret Hart was pretty cool. And the story behind that actually is kind of funny, in that I think they touched on this on the True Story of WrestleMania DVD, and maybe they didn't, but Shawn was a little hesitant about doing that stunt, coming from that high up on the zip line. And Vince McMahon is one to, he will never force somebody to do something that he himself would not do. And so in the run-throughs earlier that day, Vince hooked himself up to the harness, and Vince McMahon was the first one that day who actually took that ride across the zip line, although the arena was empty at that point. And then Shawn was good to go after that, and away he went at WrestleMania for one of the more memorable entrances in that pay-per-view's history. So, there you go. And lastly here, we got a letter from Civ Vicious of Orlando. Dear Solid Monster, do you know what that word is on Sheamus' ring gear? It looks like it reads L-A-O-C-H. Is that right, and do you know what its significance is? Thanks, Han Solid Monster. Keep up the great work. As far as I can tell, that word translates into hero. So I'm guessing that's what it means. Sheamus is indeed a hero to the Irish people, and now apparently if they turn him babyface, he'll be a hero to all of us as well. So if you have any questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com, thesolemonster@gmail.com, all one word. That is still the best place to send in questions, and certainly if you want something answered, possibly answered on the air, the only way to do that is via email. You can hit me up on Twitter as well. Follow me on there, twitter.com/solemonster, always posting good stuff on there. And friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. I may be putting some more photos up in the secret files very soon, and the only way you can check that out is by being a friend on Facebook. And it'll be interesting after last Monday to see what the live Raw and post-Raw discussion on that Facebook page is going to be like this Monday. I am a little worried, but either way, it's entertaining no matter what. So facebook.com/TheSolomonster. Check me out on there. And, of course, you can subscribe to The Solomonster Sounds Off on iTunes. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. Boom! You're in there just like that. You can download shows, automatically have them downloaded for you, in fact, and never miss a sound off. Really, why would you ever want to miss a sound off? In fact, I want everybody listening right now to go tell their family and their friends about the sound off. I can't tell you, by the way, how many people I've gotten messages from who tell me that they've recommended the sound off to other people, friends, family, girlfriend, boyfriend, what have you, their dog. And these are people who either used to be wrestling fans and are no longer wrestling fans, or they were never wrestling fans. They could hate wrestling, but they enjoy listening to this podcast. That really is a cool feeling. And hopefully, if we have any new people listening, they enjoy it as well. Email me. Let me know what you think. So until next time, be well, stay safe. We'll be back here next weekend with episode 171 of The Solomonster Sounds Off. Keep it locked in right here to SEScoops.com for all the latest news. We'll be back here next week. See you guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.